This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to another episode of New Books in Critical Theory, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm your host, Louisa Han, and I'm joined today by Josh Bauscher to discuss his new book, The Informational Logic of Human Rights, Network Imaginaries in the Cybernetic Age, which is out with University Press later this month, is it?
Yeah, it should be later this month.
Okay, great. Josh is lecturer in sociology at the University of Sussex, following a recently completed Levy-Hume Early Career Fellowship at Brunel University. He has a PhD in critical theory from the University of Nottingham, and his work has been published in Social and Studies, the European Journal of Social Theory, New Formations, and Theory and Event. Josh, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us to discuss your book.
Oh, no, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be able to talk about the book a little bit.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to having you on the show, actually, particularly as your book kind of introduced me to a range of fascinating debates in the realm of human rights scholarship, as well as some of the ways in which contemporary technology and the digital proliferation of data has helped kind of shape approaches to human rights. And to be honest, before picking up the book, I hadn't really thought in great depth about kind of the potential limitations surrounding normative conceptions of human rights. And I imagine this might also be true of some of our listeners, but I think it could be of interest to a wide range of readers, including those with a broad interest in critical theory and the real world impact of new technologies like machine learning on global politics. So I guess with that in mind, my first question is, how did you hit upon this topic and decide to write the book?
Yeah, thanks. My PhD project had already focused on human rights and a particular subfield of human rights. So without having to go into this in too much detail because it will just be distracting, but I was really interested in transitional justice in my PhD project. So transitional justice very quickly is things like criminal trials and truth commissions after conflicts. And they usually use the language of human rights to kind of articulate both what's important about the past and also what's kind of important about the future going forward. And so I was really interested, I guess, in the way that human rights discourses organized both the past and the future. And I was interested in the way that they produce particular senses of identity and selfhood and individuality that are, I guess, kind of important and necessary for contemporary capitalism or neoliberalism in particular in some way. So that was my PhD project. And this project, I guess, came from something much more mundane to do with that, which was as I was doing the research for that project, I became sort of very aware that all of these processes need things like databases and software. And so that sprung a load of questions around who does that kind of work and why. How do those databases, software processes mediate the past, mediate discourses around human rights? And so that gave me an opportunity to think about using some theoretical tools that my kind of PhD training and some of the people at Nottingham while I was there, like Andrew Goffey, those kinds of software studies approaches to thinking theoretically about the world. It was an opportunity to start thinking about transitional justice in those terms. And that theoretical approach sort of remains part of the book. But actually, as I started doing the research, I did quite a lot of archival research, and it became really clear to me that this issue spoke more broadly to human rights activism in general, and that human rights was in some ways always a kind of information politics where data, information, collecting and transmitting this information was central to the enterprise. And sort of even now, with the embrace of things like machine learning and satellite imaging and other kinds of information technologies, this idea of information was sort of central to human rights and all of the kind of databases, software, all of the kind of practices that go with that. So for me, that raised a number of questions. Why did information become so crucial for human rights activists? At what specific point? What's the history of that? But also, what's the politics of it? Is this a good thing or a bad thing that essentially we're sort of making information central to activist practices? What are the kind of possibilities and limits that poses for human rights work? So I guess those are the questions that got me started with the book. And that's I guess where it kind of came from.
Yeah, and look forward to kind of delving into some of your case studies and theoretical formulations shortly. But I think it would just be helpful to lay some contextual groundwork for the audience beforehand. So could you just provide a brief sort of intro to contemporary human rights and the dominant institutions that determine how these rights are defined?
Yeah, of course. So I guess when people think about human rights, their starting point, and probably quite rightly, is usually something like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which was developed in the post-war period, I think 1948. And so they basically define, in a sense, the ethics of state behaviour and the rights that we have as individual human beings against the state, I suppose, in some ways. So there's a main body of civil and political rights. They are things like the right to life, the right to vote, for example, but also not to be, arbitrarily maimed, killed, or harmed by the state. And so there's also a formally equal, but in reality actually quite marginalised body of social and economic rights as well alongside that. And that was largely developed by the decolonising states of the Global South. And that encompasses a kind of broader range of things. So based on the idea of, I suppose, human flourishing based on things like the rights to food, to water, shelter, and so on. And so those documents have become the basis of a kind of international legal architecture that's developed massively, especially after the Cold War period. And that includes things like regional courts, the European Court of Human Rights, which is quite often in the news at the moment, is one of those bodies, but also various bodies of law developed out of the UN and so on. But more than that, I suppose the idea of human rights that's come from that has become a kind of dominant idea in our moral universe, I suppose. They've been, I suppose, hegemonized as the basic understanding of right and wrong, or justice and evil in the contemporary world. So there's that. And then maybe to speak a bit historically for a moment, human rights didn't become that kind of dominant moral discourse, if you like, uniformly or progressively following the UN Declaration. So work by people like Samuel Moyne, but also Jan Eckel and others, show that human rights and a particular kind of thinking about human rights only came to the fore in the kind of late 1970s. So there's a few things around that. One is that the Carter administration, Jimmy Carter, the US president in the mid-70s, developed this idea of a human rights-based foreign policy. So that on the one hand, put human rights on the map. On the other hand, there was an explosion of work by groups like Amnesty International in this same period, other groups like Human Rights Watch as well. And there was this new kind of activism, I mentioned it a little bit before, but information politics, based on documenting information about violations of human rights and publicizing them in the hope that it would be possible to shame governments into changing their behavior. And this focused largely on civil and political rights, so things like arbitrary detentions, killing, torture, those kinds of things. And so there's a number of reasons that people like Moyne point out that this happened in the 70s, but things like the delegitimization of communism and revolutionary politics, as well as the end of moderate social democracy and developmentalism in the global south, because these things started to kind of wane in the 70s, human rights emerged in this period as a kind of new moral vernacular, I guess, to fill the space that was left by the kind of death of some of those political movements and trajectories.
Yeah, so in the book's introduction, you cover what is referred to as the neoliberal critique in human rights discourses, which locates the potential limitations of human rights and some of the hegemonic ideologies to emerge in, you know, the 70s and the 80s. So could you describe what we mean by this neoliberal critique?
Yeah, sure, of course. So there are lots of different versions of this, but people like Susan Marks, Jessica White, and Joseph Slaughter are really the key touchstones for me. And I make a critique of this work, but I should say that I also have used it quite a lot, and I think it's very useful as well. But the key issue, I guess, is that human rights sort of, as we know it today, rose to prominence in the late 1970s. But also, and I'm sure lots of people who listen to this will know, so did neoliberal capitalism. So starting maybe in Chile and Argentina in the mid-70s, but accelerating with Thatcher and Reagan, this new kind of neoliberal capitalism, which responded, if you like, to the crisis of Fordist capitalism in that period. So the question really around the neoliberal critique of human rights is, why is it that human rights emerged in this same period? And so the neoliberal critique argues that these things aren't coincidental, they don't just simply run parallel, but human rights and neoliberalism are in some ways deeply intertwined. And the arguments around this go in a number of different ways, but broadly speaking, the argument is that human rights provided an ethical language that doesn't oppose or is even in some accounts aligned to neoliberalism. So on the one hand, focus on denouncing physical violence, things like detentions, killings, torture, brackets off what you might describe as neoliberalism's socioeconomic violence. So the violence of rolling back, if you like, things like the welfare state, etc. And on the other hand, it foregrounds a very individualistic politics. So human rights is embedded with a concern for individual victims, a moral identification that people have between themselves and victims that's very individualistic and that's attuned in some ways to neoliberalism and runs counter, if you like, to a more structural, I guess, class or race-based emancipatory politics. That would be, I guess, in broad brushstrokes, the neoliberal critique of human rights.
Yeah, and as you sort of gestured to there, part of the aim of your book is to shift kind of critical human rights discourses away from focusing too solely, you know, on neoliberalism, to look at this, as you call it, the informational logic. So could you go into what you believe are kind of the limitations of the neoliberal critique and some of the kind of the basics of your alternative approach? And maybe kind of touch on the key characteristics of this informatic mode of contemporary capitalism you describe.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, to reiterate, there are lots of useful things about the neoliberal critique. So I think on the one hand, it's probably worth saying that there are lots of other things happening with capitalism in the 1970s. We often think about this as a break from Fordism to post-Fordism, or to from kind of Keynesian welfarism to Fordism. But there's things happening around this that I don't think neoliberalism is especially good at capturing as a concept. And especially if we want to think about human rights as an informational politics concerned with producing and transmitting information somehow. So to go into that a little bit, while neoliberalism was developing in the policy agendas of people like Thatcher and Reagan, it's also true to say that I suppose there was the emergence of what you might call the information age, the idea that new computer technologies and new discourses of information were sort of emerging in this period, particularly in the global north. This has been understood in lots of ways in terms of post-industrial society or post-Fordism, but it broadly includes, I suppose, things like factory automation, the use of logistical systems to outsource labour, the development of IT systems for financial capital, and following that, the development of things like the internet and so on. So while neoliberal policies were, I suppose, retrenching the working class in the global north, and also the anti-colonial states of the South, IT technologies were actively being sought, I suppose, by capital as a way of rooting around labour power, as Mackenzie Ward puts it. So on the one hand, you have all of this kind of informational stuff that's happening in the 70s that neoliberalism doesn't capture. And on the other hand, neoliberalism also itself, one of its key premises, I suppose, is that the market is a kind of information processor, the efficient allocator of resources. So it makes sense to think about or rethink neoliberalism in these informational terms, to think about neoliberalism as part of a broader landscape in which informational discourses and technologies are transforming capital and capitalism and society more broadly. As I argue, I guess that includes human rights. So that's, I guess, what I would mean by the informatic mode of capitalism.
Great. So let's kind of dive into chapter one now, which focuses on cybernetic capitalism, or in other terms, a mode of sort of dynamic and self-regulating capitalism supported by the accumulation and exploitation of data. So could you tell us a little bit about how cybernetics is implicated in neoliberalism's hegemonic projects and how this has impacted the human rights landscape?
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting in a way, because I aimed and argued for a while about what to try and call this kind of informatic mode of capitalism, digital capitalism. But by using cybernetic capitalism, what I'm trying to signal is the involvement of cybernetic discourses, ideas and technologies in the various aspects of this informatic mode. So just to sort of delve back a little bit, cybernetics, as I'm sure lots of people listening to this will know, developed in the post-war period as a kind of Cold War military science of information. And its whole premise, if you like, was to capture or understand the world in terms of information systems. So it was in some ways about imagining humans, the social world, but also machines, biology, nature, as information processors, as somehow systems that function by moving signals between each other. And one of the key aspects here, I suppose, is recognition. So the idea is that signals are sent between us as people or machines, or between us and machines, and the person at the other end has got to recognize it, or nothing happens, right? And so there's two trajectories of cybernetics. One is this kind of very material digital computation and technologies that are central to the transformations of the 1970s, but also, I guess, the modeling of everything as information systems, which includes society at large. And so I suppose from the 70s, what you have is informational technologies and discourses that shape understandings of the workplace, of the economy, of factories, and also, as I mentioned before, neoliberal economics. In the 1970s, I guess what's happening is this idea of information is diffusing, if you like, through society and making itself part of a kind of everyday language. And so what's interesting about that, on the one hand, is that neoliberals have already sort of taken some of these informational ideas and embedded them in this kind of idea of self-regulating capitalism, if you like, something where the market, if you like, is a giant information processor sending signals back and forth. Somehow it reaches this kind of equilibrium. At the same time, as this information age was kind of emerging, human rights groups were starting to think about what it is they were actually doing, and thinking in particular about the fact that their work was so much around producing and transmitting information, primarily to states, either through the media or to government elites, in order to shape, I suppose, changes in their behavior, to shame them somehow into doing something different. And so in some ways, there was this attempt to think by human rights groups about what they were doing, and in particular Amnesty International. And so one of the things that they started to do was to articulate themselves as a kind of information system or a network. And one of the kind of key ideas from that period was that the effectiveness of the human rights movement was based on its ability to shuffle information around effectively, quickly delivering it to the media and to government officials and so on. So there are various efforts to try and do this, and perhaps we can get into that a little bit later. But one of the important things is that because information, as it's kind of conceived from cybernetics and then kind of making its entry into everyday discourses, it relies on this idea that information is somehow easily recognizable, non-controversial, non-contestable, factual, can be passed readily by whoever is receiving those signals. And so the human rights group, human rights groups like Amnesty International take on this idea and effectively think about their own information politics as trying to somehow produce signals that governments can readily recognize. And in doing so, they opt, or they recognize that what they're doing is trying to produce facts about violations, whether they be killings or detentions or torture or whatever. And they're just interested in producing these very, I suppose, bare facts, objective kind of slices of the real that can be passed quite readily by states, that can't be easily dismissed, and therefore states, in a sense, have to recognize them. And obviously there's a kind of ideological function here in the sense that what is obviously passed as non-informational or has to be cut out and excluded are kind of politically contentious discourses. So questions around, you know, why is violence happening in particular places? What's capitalism's role in producing, I suppose, the kinds of violence that human rights groups are interested in? So there's a kind of trajectory from cybernetic ideas information that through a kind of process of diffusion becomes quite important for shoring up a kind of anti-political but also kind of deeply ideological idea of information that human rights groups are working with from this period on.
Great. So let's kind of look a little bit closer at how technologies are applied by contemporary human rights organizations, specifically on the so-called events model of human rights, in which violations are conceptualized as discrete happenings within kind of a broader network. So could you touch on the events model of human rights and how it works to depoliticize the field, maybe?
Yeah, of course. So a couple of things to say. One is that the methodological disposition of the book, if you like, is to try and start from actually existing practices and to explore those in more detail at ground level and to think about how they have this kind of depoliticizing effect. And the events model is one of those. So I mentioned before that human rights groups were doing this work to try and think about themselves as an information system. And one of the things that they kind of stumbled upon and spent a lot of time in the 80s trying to develop was standards, informational standards, that meant that information that was kind of transmitted between groups or to states had these very standard formats so that they could be moved and passed quite quickly by whoever needed to do that. And so the events model was a particular way of thinking about violations, whether that's killings or detentions and so on. So in some ways, the specific idea around the events model is, what are the key bits of information, what are the key units that are needed to produce a fact about violations? So normally, the events model thinks about violations as a specific event with a definite beginning and a definite end, where one or perhaps several violations have occurred. And so each component under the event is, if you like, latticed together in this kind of diagram, network diagram. So each violation or act that took place in the event, the alleged perpetrator of the event, and the victim. And those are the kind of key elements of the events model. And actually, that would later be coined as the who did what to whom model, i.e. Which perpetrator did what act to which victim. And so this is like the basic model. So there's a few things to say about that. That basically took near enough a decade to put together. And although it was never universally used, it's a kind of paradigm for a broad way of thinking about human rights information. And so it functions by mapping things into boxes and drawing connections between them. So an event made up of an act, a victim, and a perpetrator, and that's all kind of mapped. And so I try and think about what is happening there. And there's a kind of flat, what I call a flat ontology. You know, all that's there, if you like, are the objects that are represented by the boxes and the connections between them. And this, I think, loses a sense of depth. It erases, I suppose, social context that surrounds the objects and connections that are represented by this events model. And so while it's very good at identifying discrete units of violence, if you like, it doesn't actually offer, or it doesn't make it very easy or possible to develop the kinds of analysis necessary to confront capitalism. So just to give you an example of that, in the book I use the example of Black Lives Matter. So you could, in theory, use this events model to record instances of police brutality against the black communities of the US or even here in the UK. But if the problem is broader, or say we couldn't deal with that issue without confronting racial capitalism, which is something that someone like Yanga Yamata Taylor argues, then the model offers absolutely no way to think about that issue. It's cleaved, excluded from, filtered out, if you like, from the event, and literally, it quite literally in some ways doesn't matter. So in some ways, the events model makes it impossible to think about these instances of violence within the broader social context of contemporary capitalism. And that's why I argue that it has this depoliticizing issue, I guess.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. Great. So yeah, so moving on to your third chapter, which focuses on kind of the political valences of human rights indicators, which I found so interesting as indicators are often deployed uncritically within the logic of global capitalism to measure the development of a given society. So could you offer our audience a brief introduction to the history of human rights indicators and how they take social and economic rights away from the realm of the political, particularly the global south, I suppose, and what kind of alternative approaches might have surfaced?
Sure. So I guess to start, I think it's probably important to just briefly return to the development of economic and social rights and to point out that the development of those rights was in the middle of the 20th century largely developed by the decolonizing states of the global south. And there was a radical politics attached to those, the development of those rights, particularly the right to self-determination, which people like Adam Getachew argues was so vital to trying to articulate a kind of just post-colonial world. But in the by the 1970s, with demands for a new international economic order, or NIEO, by some of these kind of former colonized states, there was a real worry, I suppose, around the radicalism of this project and the relationship that it had to rights. So, and this is something that the neoliberal critique doesn't capture very well, because it doesn't really talk about economic and social rights. But the argument that I take in the book is that from the Carter presidency in the late 70s, there was an attempt to wrest the discourse of economic and social rights away from the global south and to produce, I suppose, new ways of thinking about it that could be quite depoliticizing. And so indicators became one way of doing that. And they emerged first in kind of 1979 with the Carter presidency. And he decides, or there's a project to try and produce indicators for social and economic rights because they're interested in measuring the relationship that states have to human rights and whether they're very good at protecting rights in the US at this point in time. So it starts, I suppose, in this late 70s period, but it's also a very non-linear trajectory because there's several attempts to try and produce universal indicators. The 80s isn't very productive. And then in the 90s, the UN has a go at trying to produce ways of measuring the level of the level at which people enjoy particular social and economic rights. So to give people a sense of what indicators are, they're basically statistics that measure the progress that a state is making in realizing a particular right. This is in their most basic form. So for instance, if we were measuring the right to food, we might measure the percentage of the population that were malnourished, and we'd hope to see that go down over time. So this is an attempt to produce indicators around economic and social rights. In the 90s, it doesn't go particularly well because actually there's an understanding that it's actually quite difficult to measure these things in a way that is, I suppose, universally true for all states, or that can be quite easily and non-controversially produced year on year. After that kind of second failure, there's an attempt to create indicators by lots of different bodies. And that's kind of the situation we're in now, where there's lots of different kinds of indicators floating around. But in terms of trying to wrest away the discourse of economic and social rights away from the South, Indicators have kind of embedded in them a particular logic that I suppose says to the global south, not now, always later, because in a sense what they're doing is providing a very precise technical measure of what's going on in a country and then asking it to make very small incremental improvements. And that kind of incremental measurement of whether a right is enjoyed or not obviously has no sense of urgency attached to it, and it suits very nicely neoliberal conceptions of development through economic growth. So the idea being that the economy will grow, and in doing so, poverty, malnutrition, all those kinds of issues will lessen as well. This is the kind of convergence narrative that you hear from people like the World Bank. And so on the one hand, it sort of pushes the urgency of justice, if you like, to the background. And at the same time, it also focuses on state compliance. So when you're measuring something with an indicator like the right to food, you'd be measuring a particular state's capacity or ability to fulfill that right. So you'd be looking at Nicaragua or, Democratic Republic of Congo or somewhere like that. But in foregrounding the state, what you end up doing is also excluding from discussions, I guess, the global economy, global capitalism, as a project which produces those very uneven situations across the globe for different states. So in some ways, indicators occlude global capitalism by focusing on the incremental improvement of situations within states. So I argue this is a kind of way of informatizing social rights in a way that both depoliticizes them and I suppose takes away the ability to make justice demands that aren't somehow measured in decades rather than with some sort of sense of urgency, I guess.
Great. So next, let's take a look at the role of so-called big data in shaping the field of human rights, as this is another quite important aspect of the book. There was, and maybe still is, a kind of techno-utopianism about statistical power of really large data sets to make predictions and understand more about the world, I suppose. So could you tell us a little bit about how big data features in human rights discourses and how faith in its ability to uncover truths has affected the politics of the field?
Yeah, sure. So I guess at this point in the book, I sort of move to the present slightly more and try and think about how the informational imaginary, if you like, of human rights, the idea that information is in of itself good and important, feeds into big data. And so there are actually lots of different ways in which big data and machine learning have become important to human rights. But the key idea really is that machine learning can be used to sift through large amounts of data or even assemble it together, especially in the case of videos, in order to produce, I suppose, an even more complete and faithful picture of the real world. So the idea is that in some ways, big data unlocks the potential to be able to produce even better, even more objective facts that can be used to shame states again. And in some ways, the problem, I suppose, that that it poses to or tries to overcome, I guess, in some way, is the fallibility of human memory or the unreliable witness or the incompleteness of evidence. All of these are very kind of practical problems for human rights groups who are interested in trying to shame states or to even garner prosecutions for human rights violations. So in general, this means is that as we've entered this era of big data, human rights organizations have responded by investing more in data and in data analysis techniques. And once again, this quest for information is about kind of pinpointing events with more accuracy. Again, with the questions around, I suppose, the structures or involvement of capitalism in these events being kind of marginalized once again.
Great. So other than big data, another relatively recent juncture in the development of digital tech is the emergence of social media. And this is something you examine in the book when you look at how the posting of evidence of violations on sites like Twitter and Facebook has affected human rights practices. So could you tell us a little more about this phenomenon, really?
Yeah, sure. So this is a couple of the key avenues for big data and machine learning sort of fold into this. So it's kind of good to talk about it. Social media for human rights groups has both become, I suppose, a very practical problem of managing information, but also a blessing in terms of the sheer abundance of information that's available and the kinds of data that they're interested in. So on the one hand, one key area, I suppose, is the amount of video evidence, if you like, that's posted on social media sites like YouTube or Facebook of things like aerial bombings, for example, but also other kinds of human rights violation. So the key question there is, how do you capture it all and how do you sort and sift through it? So algorithms and machine learning have become more and more important to human rights groups because they're used both to scrape social media for this data and then also to sort through it and also to splice it all together. So there's some machine learning techniques that are used to put together videos of human rights violations from multiple different perspectives. And so you can see quite clearly there that there's this idea that if we can just splice together enough of the information together, enough of the data, we'll have this kind of pure, unmediated object of the real in some ways that can be used as uncontroversial or incontrovertible proof of violations. So that's one trajectory that I think is really interesting. And sort of, I suppose, reimposes that informational logic of human rights, where it's really about kind of finding and producing depoliticized facts. On the other hand, there's also this idea that machine learning can be used to identify possible large-scale events before they happen or as they're happening, but early enough to be able to intervene in them successfully. So the idea is that in Twitter, in the vast archive of Twitter, there's, if you like, anomalies that can be detected. And if enough of them emerge, then this could be an indication that there's some sort of kind of mass violence about to take place or something like that. So this idea of prediction and early warning, which has been something, a kind of side project of human rights for a while now, but it's kind of re-emerging with I suppose, a bit more force now that these technologies potentially allow people to intervene before what's happening. But again, what's kind of interesting, I think, about those kinds of practices is that the idea is that the predictions take place in real time on the basis of what's happening with tweets and so on. But there's never any question about how you might predict violations on the basis of extreme inequalities, for example, or structures of capital or the dynamics of capital that make particular situations worse in particular situations. So there's this very specific narrowing down of the terms on which predictions can be made, which I think is very interesting and important in terms of thinking about how human rights politics has become very limited in the present, I guess.
So in your kind of your concluding chapter, you really kind of tie everything together by assessing how we might think outside of normative informational politics of human rights, using work by the likes of theorists, including Donna Haraway and Maurizio Lazzarato, who some of our listeners might have heard of. So could you introduce us to Haraway's notion of situated knowledges and how her work provides a starting point for intervening in the dominant logic of human rights, and if possible, maybe explain your proposed alternative epistemological framework for human rights and what this means for contemporary information practices?
As you said that question, I was suddenly confronted with perhaps the grandeur of my own arguments. Well, Haraway, I think, is a really interesting person. I mean, she's obviously a feminist who's interested in the critique of science and technology. I'm sure lots of people will be interested in or have heard of her work on cyborgs, for instance. But she's interested, I think, broadly speaking, in the kinds of epistemological practices and problems that I chart in the book. And so her essay on situated knowledges, she takes on the notion of objectivity as it's been developed, if you like, post-Enlightenment Western science. And she's interested in the idea that it sort of strives for this notion of disinterested knowledge that produces kind of purportedly faithful representations of the real, as if untouched somehow by human intervention. And she takes this on from a kind of feminist perspective. And as she rightly points out, any claim, if you like, to produce objective knowledge is imbued, or the person who's making that claim is often imbued with the capacity to hide or somehow leave their own position unmarked. And so in some ways, whenever we're producing or claiming to produce so-called objective knowledge, we're also doing it from a social somewhere that by dint of the kind of power of Western knowledge and bourgeois male Western knowledge, by dint of that, we're sort of hiding some of the mechanisms, the power and the perspectives, if you like, that go into the production of that knowledge. So that's really handy for me in the sense that it gives me some purchase to critique what human rights groups are doing, which is often making these same claims about their own information as being somehow objective and coming from nowhere. And so what she suggests, I guess, is that we should start from a situated perspective, or from the perspective of situatedness, and to think about the fact that knowledge comes from a particular kind of position, and that we can begin making knowledge, but we have to be accountable to it. And for me, this provides an interesting way of thinking about an alternative practice of knowledge production for human rights, in the sense that it provides a way of thinking about information, or possibly making information, that isn't imbued with this kind of depoliticizing attempt to be, I guess, objective or faithful to the real in some way without acknowledging the kind of human intervention or production involved in making facts, information. So I guess that's what's handy about Haraway. On the other hand, and while it is a really great starting point, it also bumps up, I guess, against a number of issues when it comes to human rights. So firstly, what happens to recognition if you're no longer interested in sort of bending yourself backwards to be recognized by the state, but you're interested in situated perspectives? What happens when you want to try and develop truths that won't be recognized as such by the state, by capitalism centers of hegemonic knowledge? And this is where Lazzarato becomes quite useful, because I guess essentially what he proposes is that truth, the truth of a fact or knowledge, isn't an inherent property of an idea, but I suppose a process. And so for Lazzarato, truth is a kind of terrain of political struggle, and that you have to fight for your perspective and to develop, if you like, a social body of people, activists, who are willing to support that knowledge and to fight for its truthfulness, if you like. And so I think when you're trying to think about alternative knowledge practices, something like that, which reconnects knowledge making with activist practices, which is something that has become very disconnected within the field of human rights, becomes really important. So then the task, if you like, of trying to produce alternative human rights information is to think about a situated perspective, to think about the problem in terms of what's adequate to understand the issue of, someone who's in the global south who's suffering from human rights violations. A situated perspective that is adequate to that would think about the broader terrain of capitalism, structures of inequality that are involved in the production of the violence that they face. And at the same time, human rights knowledge that, or an approach to producing knowledge needs to recognize that if you're going to do that, you need to be able to, I suppose, fight or battle, in the words of Lazzarato, for those truths. And so I guess that's the optimistic note I sound, I guess, at the end of the book, but one that's perhaps also says that there's a lot of work to be done, I guess, to get there.
Yeah, and quite a good, nice note to end on this podcast with, I think. So finally, I think the question now is the question that we ask everyone, is what are you working on now? Are there any projects, etc., that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. So one, I'm kind of increasingly interested in this model of information politics that we've sort of inherited from human rights, and how it works in this kind of increasingly post-truth authoritarian conjuncture that we're entering into. So that's one thing, like how does some of the arguments that I make at the end of the book, how does that relate to this kind of digital authoritarian age that we're sort of emerging in? And then on the other hand, I've got some ideas about this notion of early warning that I mentioned, and there's some work to be done, I think, on the histories of that and how that sort of comes from cybernetics that's not really been done yet. So those are the two things that I'm kind of working on now, and I guess we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, great. Sounds really interesting. Josh, thanks so much for joining me.
No, thank you very much.